Today's talk is given by Ruth Fitton of Staffordshire University. Her talk is entitled Quantifying Cultural Ecosystem Services Provided by the Landscapes of Wales. Dr. Fitton's research involves the application of spatial modelling to environmental processes on a range of spatial scales, spatial and temporal scales, local, national and regional. And her research interests lie in the fields of landscape ecology, historical geography, land use change and environmental information, and ecosystem services evaluation. She is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and a chartered geographer in GIS. She's also a distinguished graduate of our own, a distinguished survivor, should I say, of our own MSc in GIS, a qualification which she says has provided the springboard to her entire research career. So MSc GIS students take note. Ruth joined Staffordshire University in January 2012, where she is currently leading the landscape analysis component of a large interdisciplinary research project which looks at the contribution of Welsh landscapes to delivering cultural ecosystem services, and which also employs another of our ex-MSCGS students, Dr. Sam Harrison, as you can see there, as a postdoctoral researcher. So covering a range of subjects of interest to our regular audiences, we all, including our students, look forward, therefore, to a very interesting seminar. Ruth.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be back in the department, though it's slightly weird after 20 years. But thank you very much for the invitation to come talk to you about cultural ecosystem services and landscape analysis, focusing particularly on the Welsh landscape. And this work that I'm going to describe to you today is work that's come out of a large interdisciplinary research project, which is... please don't get me started. Anyway, a large interdisciplinary research project which has been funded by the Welsh Government, and it's a big collaborative project involving lots of research institutes and organisations. But my particular role in this is to examine landscapes, and within an ecosystem services framework, landscapes are very key, and they are the kind of area that fulfills a lot of the cultural ecosystem services, so landscape aesthetics, spirituality, peace and quiet, tranquility, things people like about landscapes. And what I'm going to try and explain to you today is the GIS methodology that myself and my colleagues have had to develop in order to be able to quantify something which is actually very subjective. So you can see when I get to the end of it whether you're convinced that you're doing the right thing. So, my little tongue will work. Oh no. Maybe not. I'll tell you what, I'll have to use this. At all?
Click your mouse on the slide, possibly.
Hey, there we go. Thank you very much. Okay, Wales is without doubt a very beautiful country. This is a photograph that my husband took of a Welsh landscape we were walking in only in the autumn. And you may look at that and think, well, what is it about that image which gives it its quality? Why do I as a walker like that? What is it about that landscape which provokes a kind of strong, pleasurable reaction, I suppose? The things about that landscape which might provoke a nice reaction might be to do with the water, the vegetation, the topography, but it will vary from person to person. It'll vary from where you were brought up, your views about landscapes, all sorts of things will influence how you consider landscapes. And many different things come into this. We know that the Welsh Government and the people of Wales value their landscapes. They're very lucky. They have a large range of beautiful landscapes, including probably some of the finest mountain and coastal scenery in Europe, although the Scots people might argue against that, but I'm sure you would be clear enough to say, yes, Wales does have some very beautiful landscapes. It also has lots of interesting industrial landscapes, which are also of value. And it's archaeological landscapes landscapes are particularly important. And I think it's fair to say that the landscapes that Wales have, they kind of provide this very visible evidence of human activity. Landscapes are not snapshots. You know, they're actually the product of hundreds, thousands of years of interaction between people and place. And many things come into that. It might be archaeology, field monuments, geology, biology, all sorts of things contribute to that value. And I would argue to you that landscapes are worth valuing. They are important ecosystems, they provide important ecosystem services for us because they give us that framework for our natural capital. Now, if you're not familiar with the term natural capital, it's essentially all the goods and services that wild nature provide to us as people. And that's where the terminology of ecosystem services comes in, because things only provide ecosystem services if they provide something to people. Obviously, a beautiful landscape has an intrinsic existence value, but unless somebody can see it and use it and value it, they don't actually provide an ecosystem service. And I'll let you think about that a bit. If you're not familiar with ecosystem service work, that might be quite a new concept to you. But they provide a framework for management of landscapes, but there are lots of individual components which create this natural wealth. And I would suggest at least these are relevant in Wales, and they'd be relevant in many other places in the UK and abroad. So we're looking at things like the species, the habitats, the culture, rural culture, farming culture, history. You know, Wales is soaked in history. It has many Scheduled Ancient Monuments that are extremely valued. But the landscapes are actually created partly by economic activity. And so they're always changing. And they do provide opportunities for us to be tranquil, to reflect. These are all cultural ecosystem services. And they're very difficult to measure because they're subjective. Many ecosystem services are things like carbon storage. You know, landscapes store carbon for us. That's a very direct ecosystem service. Water quality. Landscapes store water, they clean on water. There are many others, but cultural ecosystem services are all these personal things that, you know, it's very hard to put measurement on, isn't it? Because your view of what's a tranquil landscape may be very different to mine. They can, and particularly in Wales, they can be tied up with all sorts of things to do with shared identity, language, again, very important in Wales. The Welsh language has many interesting words for landscapes that we don't actually have in English, for example. And the Welsh have a very strong connection to their landscape. So how do we measure all of these things? So the project that I'm talking about is called the Glastier Monitoring and Environment Programme. And it's been funded by the Welsh Government, and I'll explain a bit more about it in a moment. But before I go on to say about that, Wales has actually had quite an interesting history of landscape work because it's got a number of really quite interesting landscape data sets already, one of which you may or may not have heard of, called Landmap, which has been in creation for at least 10 years, huge digital data set of the whole of Wales, where they've mapped the landscape into 5 or 6 different themes with huge amounts of textual narrative about the landscape. So what they did is they sent surveyors out, they went and looked at all these different parcels of landscape, and they wrote long textual descriptions about what was important about them. And it's an astonishing data set. It's very rarely used outside of Wales because it's almost entirely qualitative and it's really hard to repeat it and it's really hard to measure it. So interesting, but we couldn't use it for our work directly. Other landscape data sets in Wales that are relevant here are the UK Countryside Surveys. These are actually done by the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. And for those of you, again, who are not familiar with the countryside surveys, these were started in 1978 in England and Wales. And essentially what it is, there are 600 plus 1 kilometre squares in a stratified sample across the UK, representative of the landscapes of the UK. And these 1 kilometre squares are surveyed in enormous detail by surveyors once every 8 or 9 years. And when I say they're surveyed, they are gone over with a fine tooth comb in terms of their ecology, landscape, land use, all sorts of things. And it's the Countryside Survey which the UK government, well, DEFRA, certainly in England, well, England and Wales, uses to monitor change in the countryside. For example, it was the Countryside Survey which first flagged up the loss of hedgerows in this country, because they had this temporal series of data sets that they could look at to see how landscapes were changing. And other institutions which hold huge amounts of interesting landscape data are the Archaeological Trusts in Wales. So there's already a lot going on. So why did the Welsh Government need to pay me to come along and do something that was a little bit more quantitative than Landmap? Well, Wales, like lots of other places in Europe, has an agri-environment scheme called Glastir. This is fairly new. It's replaced some of the existing agri-environment schemes. And again, if you're not familiar with an agri-environment scheme, essentially, taxpayers, that's you and me, are funding landowners to manage their land in a sustainable way. And so there are lots of... Let me just postpone that. Sorry, this is not my laptop. There are lots of agri-environment programmes across Europe, but essentially they've all got the same fundamental reason that we pay farmers and landowners to manage their land in a way that is ecologically sensitive. And so they're not maximising their profit, but they receive some benefit from the taxpayer in terms of, for example, reducing their stocking rates if they're in Wales, to allow the flora to recover, to allow the landscape to have a better quality. They may get paid for things like restoring stone walls or putting in new ponds, that kind of thing. That's what the agri-environment programmes do. And Glastir is a new programme, and you can see there's a lot of money involved. I mean, Wales is not a big country, but the Welsh Government spends over £80 million a year funding farmers and landowners to manage their land sensibly. And so they are concerned about whether this is actually doing any good. And so Glastir covers lots of different things, as I said, you know, to do with biology, carbon storage, water quality. But it also has a large landscape component, because the Welsh Government are very keen to retain the quality of the Welsh landscape, because it's a very big tourist attraction. Wales receives, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of tourists who go because the landscape is attractive. And so they want to try and protect the landscape. And so, you know, part of the process that we go through is that we need to monitor whether the landscape component of Glastir is actually delivering better quality landscapes for the people of Wales. And that's where GMET comes in. GMET stands for the Glastir Monitoring and Environment Programme. And I'm going to explain to you how this works. So it is based similarly to the Countryside Survey, because CEH, who run the Countryside Surveys, are the lead partner in this, and they are very keen on 1 kilometre squares as a sample survey. So it is based on 1 kilometre squares, and they're stratified across Wales. And so how this works is that there are two components to Glastir. There is the Wider Wales entry-level scheme, which any farmer can go into, and there is a targeted scheme, which is focused on particular areas which the Welsh Government want to prioritise in terms of ecosystem services. And so what they've already done, the Welsh Government, are already decided, okay, we want to prioritise carbon storage in the peat areas of the uplands. And so we are going to allow landowners in those targeted areas to receive higher payments, but to do more work. So these two elements, so this essentially, the wider Wales schemes gives you an idea of the general health of the landscape of Wales. The targeted scheme is very much focused on whether specific higher payments are delivering ecosystem services as required by the government. So how it works is the 1 kilometre squares, once they're selected, these sample sites, surveyors go out in groups of three or four, they'll spend about 4 days mapping those 1 kilometre sites in enormous detail. And you can see that it is all done on tablets which are Esri enabled, so the data is captured spatially directly in the field, which has enormous benefits, and it's uploaded directly into an SDE, which I should mention. Lots of other measurements, as well as for the vegetation and the habitats, are also being measured. Things like carbon fluxes, gas fluxes, but I'm not going to be focusing on those. But it's a huge programme. The monitoring programme itself is about £8 million over the next 4 years. So they are investing a lot of money in this monitoring programme. No, how do I stop this? I'm going to carry on while you fiddle. Okay, so in terms of the landscape work, we've got these four aims. We want to assess the landscape quality of these sites, and that includes things like the complexity, the heterogeneity of it, what the built component of that landscape is like, other important things to do with seasonal diversity of the landscape, three-dimensional visual setting. We want to quantify how visually accessible that landscape is to the general public, and I'll come back and talk about that in a little while. We also, interestingly, are quantifying all the historic assets in the landscapes, and often when landscape quality assessment is done, these are not included. And when you've got a landscape as you have in Wales, it's madness not to include them, so we've been tasked with including the historic component. Critically, we need to assess the impact of change on those landscapes. And in order to do that, obviously you need your baseline, but you need methods which are quantifiable, objective, and repeatable, which is why a lot of the kind of hand-waving, oh, it's really nice, qualitative stuff, is very difficult to monitor change, and why I've spent a lot of time convincing them that they need to quantify things if we are to be able to present data over time. So the challenge for researchers in this field is, well, how do you quantify quality? And I would argue to you that, okay, so these are some of our study sites, photographs taken in the field last year, and I think everybody would probably agree with me that the extremes of the scale are quite easy to quantify. I think most people would think, that's quite nice, that's pretty spectacular. Not exactly the most exciting landscape you've ever seen in your life. This, though, is exactly the same point, turned round 180 degrees. So that bit there suddenly gets a borrowed view, which is quite nice. And your measurement of that needs to take into account that kind of spatial setting in a landscape. So it's not easy. But we can't be defeated by that. We have to actually give it a go. And thankfully, there has actually been a lot of research into landscape measurement and landscape quality, particularly in Europe, and a lot of researchers in Sweden and the Netherlands and Belgium, and particularly in Scandinavia, have done a huge amount of work looking at landscape quality. And what is it about a landscape that people like? And so we've done a huge literature review to try and, you know, get key themes that are relevant, to try and find things that we can measure. And some very common themes come out. It doesn't matter if you ask somebody in France or Sweden or Romania, virtually everybody likes a bit of topography, you know? Mountains are popular. Things going up and down are popular. Water, blue space, as it's known in landscape terminology, also very key. Water is consistently rated highly in landscapes. It's important. Some of the other key things that come out, the wooded infrastructure of a landscape. People like trees, on the whole. It's just part of our cultural framework. And of course, that cultural framework is very European. It depends where you come from as to which sort of trees you like. But, you know, in Wales, we'd be talking about hedgerows, deciduous woodlands, mixed woodlands. We're not so keen on large blocks of coniferous forest. Human activity is also something that's quite interesting. And when I say human activity, I mean evidence in the landscape. That needs to be measured. People like things like this. Stone walls, nice castles, interesting cultural components of the landscape, but they're not so keen on motorways, sewage works, pylons, wind farms. There's lots of human infrastructure that is negatively related to people's preferences in landscape. But other more interesting things are to do with colour, complexity of the vegetation. Those are a lot of the key things. And so when we know that, we can start to think about how to measure them. I'll just show you a few more photographs of some of the study sites to illustrate just a few more points to do with this. Coming back to water in the landscape, and as I said, water is always highly related to high preferences in landscapes. When you ask people, do you like this landscape? If it's got water in it, they almost always rate it more highly than if it hasn't. But we need to think about the type of water. Water isn't just water. Some places you expect it to be running, it's dynamic, it makes noise, which is also important to people's experiences of landscapes. But it can be a reflective surface, something that is to do with the light, the colour, the aesthetics of the landscape. Some man-made features may be obviously negative. There's a quarry in one of our Welsh landscapes. But interestingly, when I showed this to some art students at Stafford University who were photographers, they instantly looked at that and said, oh gosh, there's some really interesting colours, some really interesting photographs in that. Their reaction was not the same as mine, and I'm coming from a very landscape ecology background, so you always have to be aware of your own cultural filter and what biases you're bringing into it. But on the whole, Joe Public would not really like that as much as somewhere not covered with a big quarry. As I said, man-made features may be a positive thing in the landscape. Stone walls are a very nice example of that. And again, the impact of colour and texture caused by vegetation, I think you can see quite clearly here that there's our Duller's Ditch water landscape. Here's one that's actually got a little bit more going on. And particularly in the uplands, and this is obviously very relevant in Scotland as well, that flush of purple you get when the heather comes out is a culturally significant. People associate it with the uplands in Britain. People come to see it. It looks fabulous when it all comes out. You know, these things are important, and so it matters what time of year you look at a landscape as to how highly you might rate it. Again, I showed you that photograph before, but the impact of the borrowed view is also important because landscapes are not 1 kilometre squares, and that's something I'll come back to in a minute. Topography, of course. I'm very keen on mountains. One of the reasons why I moved back to the Staffordshire Moorlands recently after 20 years in the Cambridgeshire Fens is because I've had enough of the flatlands. And I miss the hills. And I'm so thrilled to be back in the Peak District, I can't tell you. But topography, very important. But if you were born in the Fens, I don't know if we have anybody here from East of England, you go and talk to people in Cambridgeshire, and they're like, oh, I love the big skies. My old boss in Cambridge, Andrew Barnford, originally lectured at Sheffield University. And he said, oh, you know, after a couple of years, I've started to be a bit closed in by Sheffield, all those hills and moors. I couldn't wait to get back to Cambridgeshire for those big open skies. So we never agreed on that, because I thought the Cambridgeshire landscape was dull as ditch water. But that's because my cultural filter is different to his. Okay, so what we did, I've showed you some of the key things that we've been considering. And what we've developed is something we call the Visual Quality Index, VQI for short, because we all love the three-letter acronym. And for our 1 kilometre study sites, essentially we have these sort of five themes that we are measuring things in. And the key thing is to find a spatial attribute that we can measure, rather than just say, oh, it's nice. And we have a range of different inputs to the index, many of which we use ordnance survey digital data combined with the digital data from the field survey to calculate. And they fall into terrain, blue space I've talked about quite a bit, green space, which we include these sort of things, number of habitats, number of species, historic components, you know, how many scheduled ancient monuments are present, is it a historic landscape, does it have lots of nice listed buildings in it, and the terrain, blue space, green space and historic tend to be positive in the index, whereas the built features tend to have a negative weighting in the index. Okay, and essentially we have a range of parameters that we're measuring. And you can see how they're distributed here between those different themes. And it isn't the number that's important, okay? It's about a kind of rating, you know? Is something better than another, which is why we have an index. So the total numeric value that we might get from all these different things we calculate, we actually convert it into a proportion. So it's all about relative differences between landscapes, because obviously you can't put a number on how nice a landscape is. That would be madness. So I'll just show you a few of them to give you a better idea of how that works. So underneath the kind of topography measures, we wanted something that, for example, would capture that thing about people liking mountains. Okay, how do we measure that? How do we measure kind of mountainous? Well, we used a published terrain ruggedness index, and we applied it to the whole of Wales using a 5-metre digital terrain model, and it classifies everything into, you know, different measures of ruggedness. It also takes into account elevation, so it's not as simple as you might think, but it gives a really good useful measure of how up and down your square is. Okay, blue space. This is just to give you a better feel for how these indexes work. So the presence of water is important. So if there is water in the site somewhere, it will get a few points. Points mean prizes in the Visual Quality Index. The numbers aren't that relevant, but points do mean prizes. The length of rivers. I've taught you already about running water is very important. The area of standing water tends to get rated more highly. And you can see that, the different lengths of streams within a 1km study site, the more you've got, the higher the value is that's assigned. Similarly with the area, the bigger the area of water, the more that you've got, you get a higher index for it. And they're simply added up. It's not, you know, there's no point being too complicated about this because otherwise you can't defend your method. The green space thing is quite a unique thing because we have this very detailed ecological survey data going into it. It means that we can incorporate not only the number of different habitats, because as I indicated to you before, heterogeneous landscapes tend to get rated more highly by the general public. They don't sit there and go, ooh, that's a heterogeneous landscape, but they tend to rate them highly if they are. So that goes into it, but we also have huge amounts of species data. So we can put in an index relating to the numbers of different species in all the different components that are surveyed, things like the hedgerow species, the vegetation species and the riparian habitats. And after much debate with the ecologists, we just decided to throw them all in because they felt all of them were important. A little one that you might have picked up there, the presence of the mouse. When I first proposed that, another one of my, because I'm kind of having to do the human geography bit of this, all the soil scientists and the carbon flux modellers were like, are you mad? What's that got to do with ecosystem services? But livestock are very important. When you go for a walk in Wales, you expect to see sheep if you're up in the uplands. You expect to hear them. If you're in the dairy part of the landscape, people quite like seeing cows. They move around, they make noise, they like hearing the lambs in the spring. And if you, I know some of you are smirking, thinking she's going off on one, but I'll give you an example of how important that is. If you remember the foot and mouth outbreak we had in this country, whatever it was, a few years ago now, and huge areas of the uplands and huge areas of England and Wales were entirely denuded of their livestock in the space of about a week because of foot and mouth. The impact on the landscape was devastating because people, there were no cows. Where were the cows? And people noticed it. Okay. So the presence of livestock is very, very important. Okay. So, I mean, I'm not going to go through them all because I'll bore you to death, but there are a lot of different inputs that are going into that visual quality indicator. And here's just a bit of a summary. So some things have a positive impact on the index. Some things have a negative impact. So like things like the area of roads and, you know, whether you've got sewage works or a quarry. Cultural elements are also key and important. And essentially you end up with a score. And as I said before, it isn't about the number that's important. What it gives us is for all these 1 kilometre sites, it allows us to put them in an order, effectively, for us to work out, well, which site, according to all these things that we know are important, has the highest score, and which ones are in the middle, and which one's the worst. And so, essentially, you get a range where each 1 kilometre site has got a value or proportion assigned to it. Now, when our surveyors are going out and collecting all their ecology and doing all the habitat mapping, they are also taking fixed point landscape photographs for this component of the work, because we need those photographs to go and ask people whether we've got it right or not. And also, they are very useful indicators to go back to measure change. So their GPS, they are located in a particular direction so that they can be relocated, and in 10 years' time you could go back and take the same photograph and see how different it looks. Now, obviously just having one measure for a 1 kilometre square of the landscape quality has its limitations. So what I've described so far allows us to order them. It allows us to work out which ones of those sites tend to be better quality than others. But, obviously within a 1 kilometre square, they're not evenly distributed. The things that make that square attractive will not be evenly spread out all over. So we have spatially disaggregated it a little bit. So we've taken it down to the 250 metre cell size. We get 16 values. And yes, it's not that fine a resolution, but believe you me, it's a heck of a lot of work. But it does give us an idea of where in this 1 kilometre site are actually those high quality components and where are the low quality components. And that's important because it feeds into the accessibility issues. Okay, so I'm going to move on. Now I've explained to you how we are quantifying landscape quality, and you may have lots of questions about that later, you may not agree with us, but we've got our method, it's repeatable, it's quantifiable, and it's objective, we think. We need to move on to think about what we've called visual accessibility, and the reason we need to think about what the general public can see is because of the ecosystem services framework. Because a beautiful landscape is a beautiful landscape in itself. It has an existence value. Just by being there, it's fulfilling lots of important functions. But it is not providing ecosystem services unless people can see it, unless people can get some benefit from that. And this is actually very key for the Welsh Government, because this is about the general public being able to access those cultural ecosystem services. If they can't get into the landscape, they can't see it. So they're, you know, it doesn't matter if it's beautiful, you know, they can't see it. It's not making any impact on them. And so what we've done is using very detailed viewshed analysis, we've worked out visual accessibility of these landscapes. And so essentially, as you may or may not know, if depends how much GIS you've done. We take detailed digital terrain models of the 1 kilometre sites. These are 5 metre resolution. And using field survey data from the ecological field survey, because it's so detailed, we can add in all of the visual barriers. Because when you're thinking about a 1 kilometre scale, if you're walking down a footpath and it is surrounded by high hedgerows, you will not be able to see beyond them. Okay, so things like hedgerows, the height of buildings, all those other things, woodlands, classic thing, trees, woods, you know, they block your view. They are added in to our model. Okay, so you end up with a kind of slightly edited digital terrain model, and then using the public rights of way network, we then calculate a viewshed from the public rights of way. And of course, in Wales, there are different categories of public rights of way. So there's footpaths, which pedestrians can go on, bridle paths, which cyclists and horse riders can go on, and pedestrians, and then of course there's the roads, which car drivers, lorry drivers, anyone can go along. And they all have different access. So for all those different categories of user and their public rights of way network, different an individual viewshed is calculated for each 1 kilometre square. It takes ages. It's very resource intensive because, as you can see, because we need to do it for the whole rights of way network, we're not just doing it from one point looking out, which is classically how viewshed analysis would be applied. We have to do it at many different points and create a kind of combined visual accessibility. It's very resource intensive, and of course we are actually going to be doing this for over 360 sites or something like that. We've done 61 kilometre sites this year, and this is kind of what it looks like looking at it. You end up with an output like this, which indicates to you, right, this bit is not visible to that particular user, the white bits here are visible. And you can see why. It's because the rights of way network is actually like this, the red dots. And this bit here, which as you can see is on top of the hill, is actually covered in dense, mature, deciduous woodland. So actually, it acts as a major block to the view. And so we actually only end up with these areas which are actually visible from the public rights of way. Now, that's all fabulous for a 1 kilometre square. It takes ages because it's a very detailed digital terrain model it's using. But the 1 kilometre square methodology, which worked really well for the butterflies, the plants, the carbon storage, the soil scientists, is a problem for landscape research because obviously a 1 kilometre slide does not a landscape make. Okay? I'm sure some of you have been thinking this as I've been talking, that this is madness, what is she talking about? That isn't a landscape, that's a 1 kilometre square. So our response to that is that we actually consider the 3x3, and we have to stop somewhere. I mean, yes, it's not perfect, but it does give us a reasonable area to work with. And so we rerun that analysis for actually people inside the 1 kilometre square and what they can see within that detailed 1 kilometre square, but also what people walking perhaps in the surrounding 3x3 square can see of our study site. So that study site that we've looked at, what is it contributing to the view of the surrounding areas? And just explain that a little bit more. If you imagine in a big valley and you've got a site that you've surveyed down in the valley, which you can't get into at all, but on the ridge lines, there are two major footpaths that people can walk along and they can see right down into that landscape, and it is contributing to a very attractive view. Similarly, when you're inside the 1km square, the borrowed view that I've shown photographs of is also important. So things start to get a bit complicated actually. We've had to do that kind of visual accessibility at many different scales. So, and this is all for the same three different groups of user. And at the 3x3 scale, obviously we do not have that detailed field survey that we've used within the 1 kilometre square. But it doesn't matter as much at that scale because, you know, whether you've got a 5 metre hedge next to you, when you're considering a 3x3, that becomes much less important. The topography becomes the dominant factor. So what we use here is obviously we can use the Ordnance Survey data to provide us with things like the length of the rivers, length of roads, how much built land there is. But we use the UK land cover map to fill in information on where the woodlands are, because the woodlands are still big enough features that they would impact on how far people can see. So it's a bit of a kind of a mixture of approaches. But yes, a lot of processing going on. So I'll just show you a few more examples. So we've got two components. We've got our visual quality index, which is a measure of all those components within 1 kilometre square that we know are important in terms of high quality landscapes. And we separately have a measure of how visually accessible that landscape is to the general public. And of course, we may need to combine those, but I've just put up here for you the range of our current 60 squares. So this is our square with the lowest landscape quality rating, but I'm showing you actually the visual accessibility. And you can see that the two are not necessarily related, in that our highest quality landscape is also one of our most visible. But we also have some low quality landscapes that are very visible, and some relatively high quality landscapes which are not very visible at all, which is of policy interest to the Welsh Government. So, just as a schematic to show you how these two things are combined. So, if you start off with your visual quality index, we know that certain components are positives, certain things give us negatives. We work out the view shed from the public rights of way. So the area in green is the bit that can be seen on this diagram. We've spatially disaggregated that visual quality index, so we know where the high and low quality features in that 1 kilometer square are. And then at the end stages, we combine those two, because that tells us, A, how much of that site can be seen by the general public, but also what quality of that 1 kilometer square can be seen by the general public. And in this little visual example, you can see that this factory site, which is a very negative landscape component, it doesn't matter in some respects because the public can't see it, and so they don't worry about it in that sense. Whereas over here, we've got a nice woodland that people would like to look at, and it gives us a high rating, but you can see that actually it can't be seen. So it's providing lots of other ecosystem services, but it's not contributing to the visual aesthetic that the general public can actually view. So that's how those two components are brought together. And that diagram here just illustrates that. So you can actually see, right, okay, what can be seen and how highly rated is it? And I'm sure you can imagine that there's lots of data and stats to process in here. But I'll just give you just some very summary information. Just so you can see the range of our visual quality index. So remember, this is a proportion of the perfect score. Our lowest rated square out of the 60 we've done this year, and we got a value of 0.28. And our highest rated square had a value of 0.69. And that square is on the coast. It's not built, it's got beautiful coastal views, very nice vegetation, it's got lots of characteristics that people rate highly. So we were very relieved when we looked at photographs. We thought, phew, it kind of works. Here is a very quick map to show you how these high value squares shake out in terms of the national parks in Wales, which there are a number. And you can see that the proportional circles, the purple bit, is the visual quality index for the central 1 kilometre square, and the open circle is this surrounding area. Now, some sites have high values for both, and pleasingly, they do fall within the Snowdonia National Park, so that kind of is cheering and makes some sense. You can see that some of the coastal squares come out as being very high quality. But, you know, there are other areas that we've got lower values. And what we will be doing is looking at accessibility to these sites, how this maps out against the population of Wales, the socioeconomic indicators of deprivation. Do people who live in economically deprived areas have access to high quality landscapes or not? And also, you know, do the protected areas of Wales contain lots of high quality, you know, are they actually working? Are they actually containing all these high quality areas? So lots of stuff to do. On average, about half of the 1 kilometre square can be seen at some point along the right of way. The lowest visual accessibility we found in our 60 square sample this year was only 0.4%. It was virtually a closed site. Okay, so it didn't matter how beautiful it was, nobody could see it. And we got one site which was almost totally visible, that site was. So it's very dense network of rights of way, probably not so much topography, and it hadn't got many trees. You can see the associated landscape quality index values there. And again, you can see that there's not necessarily in this table, there's not necessarily a strong, you know, there's not a relationship between those two things necessarily. And that has, as I keep, you know, hammering home, there's a message about ecosystem service analysis. If it's got a high VQI but nobody can see it, it isn't necessarily providing cultural ecosystem services, because the only person who can see it may be the landowner and her husband. Okay, so just to kind of bring this to a bit of a close, as time's getting on, So we've done the kind of GIS spatial analysis, and that's going to be done every year now. Next year we're doing it for 90 sites, then another 90 sites next year, the year after, another 90 sites the year after that. We're collecting and creating a lot of measures for the Welsh Government, but have we got it right? Have we really nailed what aspects of the Welsh landscape do the public actually value? We need to check this because, you know, we could be making erroneous assumptions about it. And so we have a social science component to our work, which is going to deal with these four questions here. So what aspects of the Welsh landscape do the public value? Do different socio-economic groups value the landscape in similar ways? They probably don't, we know that already, but what are the important differences? Importantly for us, not for Welsh Government so much, but we're very keen to validate our VQI approach and see whether we've got it right and whether we need to tweak it. And critically, do the landscapes which are funded through Glastir, so the landscapes where farmers are being paid to do certain things to maintain those landscapes, is it good value for money? And do the Welsh public notice in any shape or form? Do they think they're positive things or negative things? And so what we're doing is, the classic way to do this, and we're no different really, is that you do a photographic preference survey, which is where you show people lots of images of landscapes and you ask them to rate them, and we are going to be doing that. We're just in that process at the moment. And we'll also be going out in roadshow events to Wales and actually asking people, because not everybody is on the internet, and we have to be very aware that if you use the internet for your research, you can exclude a large number of groups. So you have to find different ways of doing it. So this is the kind of thing that the Landscape Preference Survey may ask. It's actually been updated since this, but obviously you get a photograph. This is one of our study sites. We might actually ask people to rate. They're actually going to be asked to rate it on the scale of 1 to 10. And they can rate lots of different landscapes. We can ask people to highlight particular things in the landscape, whether they like them or not. And you may think, well, obviously everyone's going to pick the river. What's the point of doing that? But people don't always pick the same things. You'd be surprised. For example, if there's a nice picture of a car park, a six-year-old child may well pick the ice cream van as the most exciting thing in the landscape, not the beautiful waterfall behind it. So, you know, that kind of thing's interesting. Critically, as I said, the really key thing in some respects is we need to assess whether the money that's been spent in that agri-environmental scheme to maintain the cultural ecosystem services of Wales, is it actually producing landscapes that are better? And part of the problem that we have is that, of course, landscapes don't instantly respond. So some things can happen very quickly. If you fell a conifer forest, it happens almost overnight. But if you plant a native woodland, for example, it may take 20, 30 years before it's starting to have a significant landscape impact. And that actually creates a bit of a problem because you need to model that if you're going to see if people like it or not. And so modelling it we are. And I have to say I'm a bit excited about this because it's quite cool. But one of the things that we do have at Stafford University, which is actually one of our really successful areas, is we have world-class computer gaming. So we train people to program computer games. And their abilities to model landscapes are now so good that we think we can use it. And so what we are doing is we're actually creating realistic Welsh landscapes that people can actually walk around online, like they could in, you know, World of Warcraft or whatever, but they're Welsh landscapes based on our data, and actually show them what an ecologically correct view of a landscape in 20 years' time that's had a new woodland put in would actually look like. Rather than us just doing something a bit wild in Photoshop, we are actually going to be using the ecology data to say, you plant larch in 25 years, it will be this high. It will not be a forest, it will be like this. And so people will, our users will be able to walk through those landscapes and they will assess again, you know, their preference for that. And the reason why we've been encouraged along this line, I mean, when I first presented this idea to the Welsh Government, I thought they're going to shoot us down in flames, they're going to think we're mad. And they loved it, they really loved it, because we've got a lot of hard to reach communities. I mean, when you're, you know, if you're interested in geography, geology, ecology, you know landscapes are important and you think about them in a particular way. But if you're a skateboarding youth in the centre of Swansea, who has no opportunities to access those landscapes and may think about landscapes in a very different way to you, their view is just equally important. Okay? And so that's why we're using these sort of slightly more innovative ways to try and get in touch with some of those hard-to-reach communities. And it's coming on. It's coming along. I don't want to show what we've got so far because it's still a work in progress. So you'd be delighted to see, I'm now at my summary slide. I've talked for a long time, and I really appreciate you staying with me. We've got two components to the methodology to assess our landscapes. The Visual Quality Index, which GIS derived and calculated, which is quantifiable, repeatable, and allows individual measures to be calculated. It incorporates ecology, geology, historical data sets, all sorts of things. It incorporates things like seasonal colour changes, complexity, a lot of things that have not been necessarily considered in this way before. And we've got the second component, which is the visual accessibility, which is about the ecosystem services, really. You know, how accessible are those landscapes to the general public? Again, it's quantifiable, repeatable, incorporating very fine-scale digital terrain data which has been modelled and gives us that measure of what different sorts of user can see. Three different users, pedestrians, horse riders, car drivers, and at three different perceptual scales to take account of that landscape factor, so the 1km and the 3x3. It tells us where the high-quality landscapes are, and it gives us a measure of what can actually be seen by the public. So, I'm done. We have a pilot landscape survey, which I really hope you will do for us. It only takes about 10 minutes. We'd like you to go and do it when you've got 10 minutes, and go and rate our landscapes. Of course, this is a pilot, and you are biased because I've explained in great detail the sort of things we're looking at. But we would really appreciate a bit of feedback on the survey before we spend a fortune getting it translated into Welsh and send it out to the general public. So I hope you, I hope, Owen, that we can get that sent out by the mail list. And if you have some feedback for us, we'd be really, really interested to hear it. But yes, I think that's done. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Questions, I think Bruce was right in there, but shortly follow some we'll work back. Bruce.
Really interesting talk, Ruth. Thank you very much. Something you touched on very briefly was time. I liked his words before. I'm somebody like you, I think, who likes to work with the camera and walk landscapes and record landscapes. But time works in two different ways. Obviously, you have a head that comes out. I was walking along past an industrial site just a few weeks ago that was a horrible scrubby woodland, except it had bluebells all the way through it, actually, it looked beautiful. But equally well, time also affects how you see a landscape. The trees without leaves, you can actually see a landscape. When leaves come up, the landscape disappears.
Yeah.
Weather, I can think of my favourite pot of spotted sky when probably one time in three I go up there, it's absolutely beautiful, the other two times you can't see it. So that's clearly a big issue. How do you deal with that?
Well, okay, I'll deal with the seasonal stuff first and actually explain to you how we do that. So for each of our habitats, our priority habitats, broad habitats that the site is mapped into, we have all the species, and what we what I got the student to do last year, because I'm very cruel, is he went through all of those species one by one, and using flora and ecological knowledge, what we do is we assign a dominant colour for the four seasons. Okay, so a deciduous tree is a nice example. So in the winter it's brown and bare, in the spring it might be light green, in the autumn it might go red, and back into the winter it goes bare. The colours in themselves are not so key, because obviously that's quite subjective as to which colour you assign, but what we measure is the number of significant colour changes that happen during the four seasons. So if it's a coniferous forest, it won't have any changes, it'll just be one, whereas a deciduous tree will have a number, and we've done that for all the crops as well. So that seasonal complexity is measured in that way, and that's species specific. And that is actually no insignificant undertaking, and I think it's actually the first time it's been done. I mean, it's a huge database of interesting seasonal variation. We can't capture everything. We really can't capture everything. But we've had lots of discussions about what are the significant cultural colour changes. And the heather is a classic one. But that would get picked up. That would get picked up in terms of a landscape with quite a high seasonal turnover. The weather thing is, obviously, we can't really account for that in the index, but we have to be extremely careful in the photographic preference survey, because miraculously, they had good weather this year. On most of our photos, the weather's actually quite good, but we had one set of photographs where it was a classic Welsh hill landscape, and I had to feel for these surveyors. Basically, they stood on this spot and religiously took these four photographs. And you could only see about 3 metres because it was... and so when you do the photographic preference survey, you have to try very hard to make sure you get images that are similarly lit and have reasonably similar light conditions. And it's not necessarily an easy task, and sometimes we supplement the photos with others that are available on things like Geograph, because you cannot give people two photographs where one and it's piddling down, and one it's a day like it's been this afternoon, it looks fantastic and blue. So you have to take care in the photographic preference to try and eliminate that bias. I mean, you can't always do it, and there's always subjectivity in it. You know, you can't eliminate it completely. I've tried in my anal quantitative GIS scientist way to do it, but you've got to recognise that it is a bit subjective sometimes, which is why you have to go and ask lots of people and give them opportunities to explain what it is they like, and why we're trying to incorporate a great number of things into the index that we know are important. That kind of help.
Yeah, if I'm allowed to follow up, yeah. There's one other one I can think of, which is possibly not covered by these, which is I've seen reservoirs in Scotland, when they're full, they're like beautiful logs, water, exactly what you said, but in a time of drought, they're two-thirds empty, they're like a quarry,
really,
so they actually go from something really beautiful to something really rather bare and arid and horrible.
Well, it's a tension, isn't it, between doing very nice, detailed site-based studies of one site and having to do hundreds of sites. And so we can't always put the detail in. Remember when I first showed this to National Resources Wales, to their landscape architects? They were like, oh, how fantastic. You know, you could consider all that, you know, barbed wire on the edge of towns. And I think we can't see barbed wire from space, mate. It's not that good. You know, you do have to make some decisions about how much data you can use. And it is a tension. And we've had to come up with something that's parsimonious and is realistic for the amount of sites that we're using. Because the advantage is we are going to have a data set of 360 sites. Most people who do this, and if you look in the literature in landscape research and landscape urban planning and landscape ecology, you'd be lucky if they've got 10. So there is some statistical smoothing that does help. You know, we do get a little bit of advantage from just having lots. But it's inevitably going to not please everybody. necessarily sure we did make that assessment. We're trying to
just happens after.
Well, the economic value of Wales is assessed in different ways through things like the agricultural census data. And now, I think the economists have a much better idea of the value of the farming, and of course it is hugely important. Well, it's hugely important. It probably only contributes less than 5% of the GDP. But culturally it's important. We're not measuring that specifically, but it's measured by other things, and that isn't really part of what the GMET thing is all about.
Yes, it's maybe not necessarily measuring it directly, but it's sort of how we should kind of lay kind of this study on the table, how about the later stage, how would you kind of argue the value, you know, your life's kind of value.
Well, I mean, the other thing that fascinated me is when we presented this to the National Farmers Union in Wales, they were lukewarm about their carbon measurements. They were, you know, somewhat disinterested in the soil monitoring and the birds and the butterflies. But when I got up there and talked about the landscape and the fact that it's managed and how it looks is important, they were thrilled to bits, because they were saying, thank God, somebody's recognising that it's only like this because we do what we do. And they were thrilled to bits, interestingly, which wasn't what I was expecting. So, I'm not really answering your question, because we're not doing that. It's measured in different ways. But, you know, the fact that much, you know, a lot, and they're also quite interested, because they think a lot of the things they're being paid to do by Casteer are not worthwhile. And we may show that. And when I say not worthwhile, the Welsh public isn't bothered by them. You know, but it may be that might be one of the outputs of this, that, you know, we show people what these landscapes look like if you maintain the stone walls. And it isn't something that is particularly rated that highly by the public. And there is a bit, we have to be careful, because obviously we can't get caught up in the politics of this. And I'm sure you can imagine that the politics are quite fierce, actually. We have to retain our objectivity and step outside that a little bit. But the farming community are actually particularly, you know, excited about the landscape work, because they think it is actually capturing something that isn't often captured. So, yeah. And they don't think I'm mad for including whether there are sheep or cows in the fields or not.
No,
I know what you mean. So I haven't really answered your question, but hopefully I've given you some reasons why.
I have a question. It's not a very well-formed question. And it's related to the last question, actually. You said a couple of times when you were talking about those certain features that we know are important. And I was thinking, well, how do you know? I work in a different field, and what you were describing reminded me of sort of modelling that I'm used to doing, where you start with an answer, as it were, which in your case would be a set of human judgments of landscape, and then you extract features like whether there are cows or not and what view it is, and then you build a model and you run it and adjust the weights of each of those features until you can match the human judgment. So if you've got, you know, 50 of them were classed as 10 and 30 of them were classed as 2 and so on, and when your model comes out with everything in the right buckets from 1 to 10, then you've got the weights right, and you may have to discard some features which actually don't help. They actually are counterproductive in building a model. And I was wondering if that was completely irrelevant to what you're doing, or is the kind of thing that you do anyway?
Weighting is an interesting thing. It's a very sensible question. We pondered whether we should weight some things in the index more than others. And we had lots of discussions with this, lots of people. We thought about it quite a bit. And then we decided not to in the first instance, because we are imposing a judgment on it. And, you know, why should we weight the green space more than the historic? or should we weight the historic features more importantly than the green space? And what you end up doing is annoying a lot of stakeholders. So I think I do understand what you mean, but we haven't weighted them, apart from the fact we've got more of some than others. Yes, you are right. We are. Yeah, there is. We have included more of some things than others. You're right. So there is an inherent weighting.
What I'm suggesting is not deliberately weighting them yourself. The model decides the weight.
You
run the model until it matches the output you're targeting, and then you look and find out what the weights were. But you don't need to tell anybody, including yourself, what the weights were.
I suppose, but do we ask enough people? Are we asking the right number of people? When do we decide that we've got the perfect answer, you know?
But I was wondering, how else can you do it? How else can you be normative about it?
You can never be completely objective about landscape analysis. You can be about functional landscape analysis, but this kind of qualitative thing is almost inevitably... You know, you're always setting yourself up for a fall, and you always have to defend your position in some respects, because there'll always be somebody who doesn't agree with you. So it's kind of a case of, well, you go with the majority, and that's all you can do. And so those things that we picked were from hundreds of studies. You know, thousands of people were asked. But they may still not be right for the Welsh landscape specifically. Mm. So that's part of where... The preference survey actually is quite key, because, you know, we don't know if we've got it right yet. So we may need to consider whether we equalise the impact of those five themes. So that's perhaps something we could do. But one thing that we do have a problem with is the historic side, because that tends to have too big an impact on the landscape quality, we think. So, for example, I'll give you one example. We've got one site that's got 12 scheduled ancient monuments in it. It's a landscape of archaeological importance. And in our index, that ticks loads of boxes. When we actually look at the photographs of it, we're like, what? It's from later we go through it. And it's because, you know, there's a church, there's an important little house. These scheduled ancient monuments are tiny. And they actually don't have that landscape impact that we were envisaging, because, you know, Cadw, the historic body in Wales, are, you know, they were on our backs from the start, and you've got to include these in this index. This is critically important. Made a huge noise, so we had to put lots of them in. But we were actually considering taking them out of the index and considering them separately. Well, they can sometimes have a big impact. And you look at the sites and you just think, nobody would say that was a nice landscape. It's a very average landscape. And would the fact that there's some tiny... So things like deserted medieval villages, 99% of the general public will never know what they are. They'll just be like, why are all these bumps in the field? You know, they don't care. It doesn't make an impact on them. So, yeah, we've still got some thinking and work to do on it. It is... a challenge, as I said at the start, in many different ways. But we think we've done our best at the moment.
I think we're getting close to drinks time. The postponement may take care of that, but we'll take two final talks.
I'd like to follow up a bit on that. I'm really interested in the historic landscape, but I'm also interested in the policy side of it. So I guess I'm really interested in what you've presented today, because it shows trying to grapple with this whole being greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I was with you up until the point where you're saying we want to take the historic stuff out.
I was never going to. I just think sometimes we'd like to.
I also agree with you to some extent, because one of the things we have an issue with in the historic landscape community is an obsession. Obsession is too strong a word, but a concern with point data. And actually, how on earth do we map the historic landscape? What the hell is it for a start? And what does it mean? And I suppose one of the things I'd be interested in is how your enormous transdisciplinary and all your partners, how do you work together? How many did you coalesce into groupings of people that generally agreed and bits fell away? And I think one of the other things I'm interested in is how much of it is a knowledge base? Because we know if we take individuals to an area and say, what do you think of the landscape? They will see it, they will describe it. If you then provide them with certain pieces knowledge about habitats or about historic time depth, their perception will be different, because they will then value it and treat it in a different way, because they will see something different. And so are we saying that it's unimportant because the vast majority of people don't know what it is? Or are we saying actually we need to build in an element, a different weighting perhaps, that somehow, I don't do the numbers, but somehow recognises that and timed it? Mm. There's too many questions in there, but I think it's triggered a lot of things that are really interesting. Yeah. I'm interested in how you all work together.
So I'll tell you one thing that we are doing in this. Once I showed these preliminary results about the footpaths and what people can see in this idea of visual accessibility, one of the very first sort of things that the Welsh Government said was, oh, you know what, that means we could target new access routes to sites that have actually got no access but are high-quality routes. So from a policy point of view, that's quite interesting. But yes, I mean, maybe it's about education, isn't it? You know, we are, I mean, the landscape theme is only one work package of loads. I mean, you know, I'm obsessed with this because this is what they're paying me to do. But, you know, we're actually doing soils, butterflies, birds, soils, carbon, water quality, all sorts of things. So the final assessment is much more holistic and integrated than that. And I suppose, you know, it's not just me saying it's a nice landscape. The soil scientists may come along and go, this is a peat landscape which is storing huge amounts of carbon, and we need to explain to people why it's important that we fund farmers to look after that peat landscape. So it is an educational thing. There's lots of other stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think, Bob, you have the honour of the final question.
Some kind of loosely connected bits, which I'm still thinking about.
It's the nature of the topic.
It's very interesting, and it's obviously quite pioneering work in stimulating and seems not my field.
Feel big book.
I think one of the phrases you used was the public value of the landscape. I wonder, connecting maybe with the historical dimension and the role of people who are sensitive to the history of the landscape. I mean, I can maybe rather crude example in the Highlands of Scotland. Polish friends who tour around the Highlands of Scotland often come by in Edinburgh and say how wonderful it was. The glens are empty, so quiet. Or desert, real wilderness. Now, I know that sometimes if I go to those lands and I know the history, I'm rather sad because I know the lands are empty because people were removed, often quite brutally, when they didn't want to go and they had to go to Canada.
And a lot of those landscapes are very wrecked.
So the public, the way we react to landscape, I mean, there is that net, in that case, it's a rather good example, but there is that net, there is that cultural sensitivity, historical sensitivity.
Yeah.
And coming to South Wales, particularly to South Wales, well, and Wales is a very interesting industrial history. I've seen very spectacular shots of what it was, Bronze Age mines and animals here and things like that.
Yeah.
And the slate quarries and
rock. Slate quarry, the slate landscape is probably the
one. And I mean, that's spectacular. But for people coming to public value, public value of the landscape, as I understand it, South Wales has a very important role in British social and labour history. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Welsh coal miners and steel workers had a leading role in improving workers' rights in Britain and they were sometimes quite bitter struggles, but they were resourceful. Some of the basic ideas that led to the development of the National Health Service were invented really by Welsh coal miners getting together. Now, for people who are interested, and I'm sure a lot of Welsh people and people from outside Wales are interested in where those things happen and how they develop in the local context. Now, that's public value. Now, maybe that's a separate exercise from, and also the history of the settlement, how people lived in the Welsh valleys in the early
landscapes of historic significance are mapped and are included, and some of those are designated because they are archaeological industrially important. So the slate landscapes, for example, are in there as a positive indicator in our index because they fall within a landscape of historic importance. Now, what you're talking about is actually the land map approach that Wales has already done. Now, I don't know if you've ever looked at a land map, but if you're interested in that kind of thing, I really encourage you to go and look at it, because that is a very textual, very descriptive thing. So what it will do, it will map a little area of village and go, the surveyor who will have been historian will be writing exactly that kind of thing. You know, this particular row of cottages is very important because these were the first cottages that, you know, housed the copper miners, and that is actually really incorporated quite well into Landmap. So we didn't want to. It was very important that our work did not repeat Landmap, but was, you know, an added benefit to it, works alongside it. It does different things. It's partly incorporated in some of the historic stuff, and I completely agree with you. And another part of trying to deal with that is, we're sending a lot of this out just to the general public. It'll be out on internet forums, wherever we can get it, actually. But we are also targeting the kind of social science component of this, stakeholder groups that are key. So, you know, historians, archaeologists will be one of those stakeholder groups. But it's important that, you know, a lot of these people are always consulted. You know, a lot of what we're trying to do is to get the more general picture for the landscape of Wales. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. Landmap does a lot of that, I would suggest. And if you're interested, do go and have a look at it. It's a fascinating approach, utterly dreadful to work with if you're a spatial scientist, because it's every single polygon has got a unique, huge 5,500 words of text that you can't do anything. And there's a database, and, you know, anybody who's done it in a database and will know that's the worst possible way to do it. But it does capture exactly that kind of thing that you're talking about.
Okay. Something to look at. I might look at it in my holiday in Wales next month.
Excellent. I hope you should be looking at that landscape thinking, oh, blue space, green space, topography.
Yes, I look forward to it. Well, thank you very much indeed. Various announcements. Thank you all for coming. This past year, there is another talk next Friday lunchtime, bolted on. So do, if you can make it, do come along. But it just remains for me to say thanks once again, and thanks to all the volunteers for helping. So it just remains to go to Geodrink, so do come for that as well if you can. Minimal topography involved, just across the road. We should all make it there and back, hopefully. The optional topography later on, downhill. But, yep, do come. So, thank you very much to Ruth for a very interesting talk.
Thanks a lot. Thank you all so much.